Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The utterly conventional two segments today. Conventional in number, but not in content. Vijay Prashad will talk about bourgeois rot, and Vladimir Ishchenko will talk about Ukraine during and after the USSR. For many years, I've been thinking, writing, and talking about the rot of the American ruling class. I've been meaning to turn these thoughts into a book for most of those years, but so far, I've lacked the self-discipline to do so, though I must summon the resolve. I have written several articles for the Socialist Register on aspects of the topic, a piece on the decline of the WASPs for Harper's, and a long essay called Take Me to Your Leader, my notional title for my notional book, for Jacobin. So I'm always on the lookout for people with smart perspectives on this issue. The other day I saw an essay by Vijay Prashad written for Globetrotter, an international syndication service, with the title The Remarkable Decline in the Global North's Leadership. It's always good to hear from Vijay, who has a remarkable breadth of interest and speaks about them very well. He's making, if I'm counting correctly, his 13th appearance in Behind the News. Vijay grew up in India and then spent many years as a student in the U.S. and then later as a professor at Trinity College in Hartford from 1996 to 2017. Tired of the academic life, he threw it over to become director of the Tricontinental, which describes itself as a people's global think tank. He's a prolific writer with over 20 books to his name, most recently Struggle Makes Us Human, written with Frank Barat and published by Haymarket, and The Withdrawal, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, and the Fragility of U.S. Power, written with Noam Chomsky and published by the New Press. Despite their often grim subject matter, Vijay is not given to despair. I often look to him to counter my own tendencies towards gloom. Back in August 2011, I was ready to give up on politics. I'd gone so far as to set up a blog called Why Effin' Bother. I was planning to use the full word, not the censored version, designed to pass muster with the FCC, and invited some writers I admire to convince me not to throw in the towel. Among those who responded, Bhaskar Sankara, who'd just started Jacobin, and his contribution opened because we're on the right side of history, and Vijay, who has an uncanny ability to find hope amidst defeat. And then 2 months later, Occupy exploded, and I put my despair in storage. Okay, now here's Vijay Prashad. It seems to me that there's a crisis in the Western, I know that's a highly mystified concept, but let's bracket that for now, in the Western leadership class. And this is really brought home with our preposterous presidential election. Your piece, you open with a couple of French students talking about the current political scene, but it really brings home just what a pathetic situation is. What are your thoughts on precisely, not merely these two candidates, but what they stand for, what they symbolize?
Well, isn't that the immediate problem, is what do they really stand for? And it's not merely Joe Biden, for whom I feel some compassion, because the man is 81. And in recent days, Doug, you and I mean, you don't even have to be a regular or obsessive user of social media to be sent videos or watch him on television. I mean, Mr. Biden seems to be deteriorating quite rapidly. And it's just sad to see somebody like that, you know, confused in public, not able to hold it together when asked a question. And in the last couple of days, I watched the video where he said, if I take questions, I'll get into trouble. It was terrible because I felt...
Well, yeah, then he was silent for 20 or 25 seconds.
Right after that, yeah. And, you know, he said, I'll get into trouble, but he never said from whom. Who's going to yell at you, Joe?
You're the boss, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're the president, you know. You said, I'll get into trouble. I felt sad at that moment. I feel some compassion for him. You know, Mr. Trump is a quite different character because he's not stumbling around. I mean, the guy is a very effective and, I would say, charismatic communicator. That's not his problem. You know, they have different problems. But what they share is a lack of an agenda, not only for the United States, but for the world. And again, it's not just Trump and Biden. I was walking through the Frankfurt airport the other day. Frankfurt is the center of German finance. It's really the showcase city of Germany in terms of international capital. And, you know, just going from one gate to the other, I noticed that three of the walkways were under repair. Somebody could say, look, it's anecdotal. You know, it's just one guy walking through one airport at a certain point when they decided to repair not one, not two, but three walkways in a very large airport where there are many walkways. Well, okay. But sometimes anecdotal evidence is quite compelling. The same airport, my flight landed in Frankfurt from Tunis, and everything just seemed broken. The snorkel wasn't working properly. As I said, the walkways were under repair. There is a kind of lack of investment in public infrastructure that is related to this decline of leadership. And if I ask most people in the United States, I'm guessing that most of your listeners are in the United States, and if I ask them, who's the Chancellor of Germany? It's unlikely that they'll come up with the name Olaf Scholz. It's unlikely, partly because he's so mediocre and plays no impact in international debates. And yet, you know, major country in the world, leading OECD country, and, you know, you've got an airport that looks like it's crumbling.
Well, yeah, they're very familiar to America, that sense of a crumbling infrastructure. But yeah, as you point out, that the European leadership class isn't much better. I mean, Scholz, Macron, I recall during the midst of the euro crisis of the last decade, Yanis Varoufakis comparing the EU leaders of that time with the leaders of a generation earlier, Kohl and Mitterrand, and noting a real decline in quality. And if anything, I think the current crop is even further decline in quality. It's not like Europe is an exception to this in any way.
Not at all. I mean, we just need to cross the channel, and there's Rishi Sunak. There's the British Parliament, which couldn't have an authentic discussion about the Israeli attack on Gaza. I mean, the UK Parliament used to be called the mother of all parliaments. I mean, what a joke. The Speaker of the Parliament didn't permit the Scottish National Party to table a resolution calling for a ceasefire. Now, that was a day, the day when the Scottish National Party was tabling their resolution, that was a day set aside for opposition resolutions. And because there are a number of different parties in opposition, the Labour Party, Scottish National Party, and so on, Sinn Féin doesn't take its seat in the British Parliament. But that day was set aside for the Scottish National Party. It had a legitimate right, in other words, a procedural right to put an amendment on the table. And yet the Speaker scuttled that because he didn't want to embarrass the leader of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, because if this resolution had been actually taken up on its merits and by itself, sections of the Labour Party would have probably, most likely, either disobeyed the whip and voted with the Scottish National Party, which would have embarrassed Mr. Starmer, or they would have been forced to vote with Mr. Starmer and basically torpedoed their re-election chances when there is an election this year in Britain. Meanwhile, you know, Rishi Sunak, pabulum. I mean, you know, really, between Sunak, Macron, and Olaf Scholz, it's really hard to pick who is, and I'm going to use a word which I don't want to get misunderstood for. I don't mean this word in an elitist way, but it's very hard to pick among the three of them who is the stupidest head of government.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem like they're serving their long-term class interests very well. Their politics aren't ours, but on the other hand, do you think the bourgeoisie would have some more competent managers at the head?
Well, they must be begging for people like Angela Merkel to return. What is a capitalist government expected to do? They have just a few things really to manage. You don't have to do a million things. You have to make sure there's no general rebellion. So at some level, you have to produce some forms of social welfare. General rebellion is not really something you want, but you also don't want to have too many people sleeping in the streets in the capital city. You know, that's also something that a capitalist leader is supposed to do. Well, firstly, they cannot stem the general rebellion. In France, there's been rolling protests of different kinds, farmers, people upset about rising prices and so on. Britain, there's been an avalanche of strikes, you know, going back now almost a year and a half. So the general rebellion seemed to be rising in intensity. People sleeping on the street. I mean, I'm talking to you today from Barcelona. The streets are filled with people on cardboard boxes. So these are two things they're supposed to do. The third thing that a good capitalist or bourgeois leader of a state is supposed to do is to basically ensure the soundness of money, to ensure that those with wealth are not seeing their wealth deteriorate. I think that's a big part of their task. And also to ensure that the people with property and wealth are able to increase their property and their wealth in a way that's manageable. These are pretty reasonable set out tasks over the past 100 years. I was reading the Financial Times the other day. There's a crisis in the U.S. Treasury market. You know better than I. You wrote the book Wall Street. But the U.S. Treasury bonds play an important role in stabilizing the global economy. And the very fact that after the repo crisis of 2019, that the managers of the U.S. Treasury market, those who try to keep that market relatively sane, haven't been able to figure out, haven't created a strategy to take care of the chaos in that market, you know, whether it's to the creation of enforceable, some counterparty agreements, some agency in between that basically ensures that buyers and sellers don't just vanish from the market. All of that, they haven't been able to do that. And there are some proposals on the table, but the banks don't like it. The big bondholders don't like it because this is going to mean that they can't make risks right up to the limit of their liquidity, you know, and more, what they borrow. So these people are not actually doing the basic tasks of a capitalist government. They're not making sure there's no general rebellion. They are not making sure that there's not too many people sleeping on the street, making the center of the city look ugly. And they're not really, you know, protecting money, the soundness of money. It's chaos. Reading the Financial Times, which I do every day, I'm puzzled often by the kind of decisions made by these managers. Now, you can't blame Olaf Scholz and Macron and so on. They are under immense pressure. And that's where the story gets interesting, Doug, because the question is, what's the pressure that they're under? Why can't they fulfill the basic tasks of a capitalist government? Well, look at the pressure they're under. Right now, every single European state is under pressure to underwrite this war in Ukraine, which is really quite expensive. And it's expensive not only for the people who are paying with inflation in various sectors of ordinary social life, energy, food costs are up and so on, but it's expensive for public finances because you're now having to actually basically underwrite the armaments going into Ukraine. And that is quite expensive. You're also under pressure through this quote-unquote agreement around NATO to lift your arms spending up to 2% of GDP, which many countries don't are not even near that. You do all those things. You can't really have good infrastructure in your country. You don't really have the funds to make sure that people are not sleeping on the street. You don't really have the real funds to prevent a general rebellion. And you certainly don't have the capacity to discipline the bondholders and the money makers so that you can have, you know, some sound money policies. And I don't mean sound money that's not related to austerity, like good sound money, but bad sound money. You can't even do that. You have a completely unregulated setup. You just don't have the resources to do anything. And I think a resourceless government, which is resourceless only because it's transferred so many of its resources to the military or to military type of activities, this produces this kind of mediocrity. I mean, it's not like I know Olaf Scholz and can pronounce anything on his character. Maybe he's not a mediocre person, but the job of Chancellor of Germany now can only produce mediocrity because there's no space for maneuver. They don't have room to be a good chancellor. You know, if you're made a president of a declining bank, for instance, and you don't have any options, you're going to be a bad president of that bank, regardless of your talents and abilities. When I say that, you know, these people are mediocre, I don't mean this necessarily in a personal way, that if you get more competent people, I mean it in a structural way. There is a kind of mediocrity in leadership because the structure is not giving them any space for maneuver. It's not giving them any space for maneuver, and they're quite happy not to have that space for maneuver. By the way, they don't seem to be complaining about it.
I'm reminded of an essay that Etienne Balibar wrote a few years ago, in which he says that today's bourgeoisie has no project of civilization. It's all cost-benefit analysis. But unlike the bourgeoisie of 100 or 200 years ago, there's just no ambitious long-term goal or no vision animating their political lives, their imaginations. And it seems to pervade the whole society, but it does seem to be a particular affliction of the leadership class.
It's interesting how you put that, and I haven't read Balibar's essay. Very smart man, by the way. I enjoy reading his reflections on a range of issues. But it is interesting when you even think of the concept bourgeoisie, firstly. Bourgeoisies are not built overnight. They are a product of history, culture, social networks. It's not just about wealth. You know, a rich man or a rich woman don't make a bourgeoisie. Bourgeoisie has a long history of formation. We've read lots of books about the making of the European bourgeoisie. It takes a lot of effort, time, educational traditions, a certain form of cultural monopoly and so on. Out of that comes a project. There's a bourgeois project. They have a vision for what society should look like. The city must have a museum. It must have an opera hall. It must have a park where people can come and have civic activities. It must have a city hall where citizens can come and make a complaint or whatever. The bourgeoisie had a vision, which they translated into urban planning. They translated into city spaces. You know, it was not just that they were rich people. I think that's an error. But we live in a world where, in a way, it seems, for different reasons, the bourgeoisie globally has declined. So let's reflect on some of these reasons. I think, and I'm just reflecting with you, but I think that after the collapse of the USSR and the kind of globalization project that was put on the table, the bourgeoisie seemed to, at least the Western bourgeoisie, seemed to lose its sense of its own, let's call it, for want of a better word, national project. It became released from its own territory, the cities in which it lived in, and so on. There was so much upward distribution of wealth that people just had like three houses. You know, you've got a house in the Hamptons, you own an island in the Caribbean, you have an apartment in New York. Your kind of landscape is no more the opera house, the city hall, and so on. It's the first class section of the airport. It's the private jet. It's one house to the other, and so on. Your imagination changes. You zip off to Davos to meet each other, to talk about what? What are you talking about? You talk about climate change there. But it's not really about climate change. It's about appearing to be somebody who cares. There's a kind of facade of caring about the world, but you don't really care about any place. They have become rootless. They are deracinated. So from the West, I think there's been a kind of deracination. In other parts of the world, Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, it's even more complicated because, after all, the workers' state in 1917 and then in Eastern Europe after 45 actually did uproot the bourgeoisie. They either sent them into exile, killed them or whatever. There was no bourgeoisie. They had some sort of other kind of state. But when these workers' state collapsed in 1991, a bourgeoisie doesn't appear. In Russia today, there is no bourgeoisie. You know, there are rich people and then there's a state apparatus. You don't have that class that is built over hundreds of years and so on. Doug, we are living in a kind of post-bourgeois world, but it's not a socialist world. It's something else. And I've been trying my best to understand what is this class that is dominant today. Does the United States, and this is a genuine question, does the United States actually have a bourgeoisie? Is there a bourgeoisie there? Because it seems to me that a lot of the people, let's say the classic California or the, you know, Eastern Seaboard elites, the old elites, are not really interested in driving an agenda. You know, they're not the ones, by the way, and their children are not the ones running for office and making big pronouncements about the kind of America we want. Instead, you have this caricature of the East Coast person, which is Donald Trump, who says, let's make America great again. But what America are you talking about? And Trump then says, well, you know, the people I meet at Mar-a-Lago and then wherever, somewhere, you know, in Maine and Bar Harbor or wherever, people I meet in these closed gatherings, they don't care about America, he says. And maybe he's right. They don't care about America because they're deracinated from that. And so he then comes out as a caricature and says, let's make America great. But how, Donald? What is your project? Closing the border, building a wall is not a project. In fact, that's really just demagogy. I mean, what comes afterwards? If you seal the border, how are your farmers in California going to survive in the short term? Which U.S. citizen is going to go and work for the kind of wages that the migrant workers work for in the strawberry fields in California? You know, have you thought this through? I mean, a project is not just a slogan. A project has to have several elements. You know, it has to be a very complicated vision for society. That's just missing. And I don't know. I'm speculating a little bit. Balibar says, you know, that these people just have a cost-benefit analysis. They don't have a civilization. I would say something even, maybe, I don't know if it's deeper than that, but something that's more sociological even than that, which is that when we talk about these people, you know, the bourgeoisie, it's not just that they have a cost-benefit analysis, but their sense of their own location, their own geography, is no longer rooted in cities and so on, where their ancestors used to build things like the Guggenheim and so on. they seem to want to build a space station and fly out to it and, you know, sit in a jacuzzi all day up there and just enjoy themselves. That's where they want to go. Elon Musk is going to build his museum in space.
I'm speaking with the historian and journalist Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. How would you apply an analysis like this to Modi's India?
It's interesting. Modi's India is different because India actually does have a bourgeoisie rooted in the 19th century. This bourgeoisie developed in the interstices of the colonial economy. For instance, in the steel industry, the British were not keen in making large investments in India because they were making large investments in the UK. But they needed steel to build the railway lines and so on. And, you know, they allowed certain Indian capital to develop. So the Parsi family, the Tatas, developed the Tata Steel Factory in eastern India. Or during the great U.S. Civil War, when cotton went out of the market, they started buying cotton from Egypt and then from Kenya, the highlands in Kenya. Well, when the Civil War in the U.S. ended, there was a glut of cotton. So the British imperialists allowed Indian traders in Western India, in Gujarat and so on, to buy Kenyan cotton because they didn't want those farmers to stop growing cotton. You know, it's useful to have extra cotton at the time. So these Indian capitalists were able to buy the cotton and set up textile factories in Gujarat. They are the ones who funded Gandhi, for instance. So India has had a history of building up this bourgeois class, which has had a directive attitude towards Indian modern Indian culture. They participated by funding and financing in different ways the freedom struggle. Gandhi's biggest funder was Jamnalal Bajaj, one of these cotton textile magnates in Gujarat. The, you know, contradictions of the U.S. Civil War produces this class in Gujarat. And they have a kind of an unbroken history. The Ambanis, the Adanis, they come out of that tradition. It's not a nowhere. So the Indian bourgeoisie actually has not been disrupted in its long history. When India, quote-unquote, liberalized, Doug, in July 1991, these sections were actually not keen on liberalization. Many of these sections, I remember that the Indian bourgeoisie was divided. One section wanted to become the comprador of multinational corporations. Let, you know, a big firm come in, let Siemens come in, and I'll be the Siemens India manager. And that's the limit of my ambition. But others were dispirited. They thought that if import substitution ends, the tariff subsidy provisions end, they'll get wiped out by international capital. Some sections of that Indian bourgeoisie weathered the storm through the period of opening up. And when Modi came to power in Gujarat as the chief minister about 20 years ago, some of these Gujarati capitalists put their wagons to his locomotive, and particularly Gautam Adani. And Modi moved a lot of government financing towards people like Adani and so on. In many ways, what happened in India over the last 20 years is what happened in the previous era in South Korea. The building of the chaebols, you know, these giant companies which were effectively integrated into the state structure. They got easy access to state funding. State banks opened the coffers to them and so on. And they grew and became multinational corporations. Mr. Adani, for instance, owns the port of Haifa. You know, he owns a large part of the port of Dubai. He owns two ports in Greece and so on. He has an enormous global footprint. When Financial Times went after him in an expose saying he's overexposed, well, of course he's overexposed, but I mean, come on, who isn't? I mean, these guys function by being overexposed. I mean, Trump is overexposed. When people say, well, Trump is lying about his wealth, that's ridiculous. Every capitalist is overexposed because that's how they continue to grow. I mean, Trump is a really dangerous and diabolical person. But my God, to have people in New York saying, well, he's not worth what he claims. Come on. Who among you is actually worth what you claim? A lot of your value is paper value anyway. You can't go and cash it in. You don't have the liquidity that you anyway claim to have. And many of them live off borrowing against fixed assets that are stuck somewhere. So that's all nonsense. Mr. Adani is just like that. But see, because of the unique history of India over the last 100 years, this section of the capitalist class, this section of the bourgeoisie, is completely united with sections of the state. And therefore, I make the comparison with South Korea. They're like a chaebol, like the big South Korean houses, business houses, which still exist and still have this relationship with the state, somewhat depleted, but it still exists, that structure. That's what you have in India. So this is, bizarre way, a patriotic bourgeoisie. Now, it may not be the patriotism that I like, but it's nonetheless, it is patriotic. It's not saying, let's take our earnings and let's park them in the city of London. They're not doing that like they used to. There was a time when the high point of neoliberalism, when the Indian elite was parking their money in Panama or in the city of London or in New York. They're not doing that. I mean, I was interested as in comparison. A lot of the Indian bourgeoisie is actually parking their money in India. It's an interesting comparison. And they're parking their money also in investments, not in finance. They're buying assets of different kinds. I was stunned looking at the German situation. If you look at the amount of wealth in Germany, and then you look at the wealth in the DAX, there's a huge variance. And when we looked into this in our institute, what we found was that a lot of big German money is in fact sitting in Wall Street, which demonstrates some of the subordination of Germany to the US. You know, they just can't make a break with the United States because their wealthy class is actually as committed to the longevity of the United States as they are to Germany. Maybe perhaps more the dollar in the United States than to the euro.
Yeah, this is one reason that the euro can't be a serious rival to the dollar yet. Let's conclude by talking a bit about the Gaza crisis. And we're seeing really unprecedented levels of protest in a lot of Western countries. And at the same time, we're seeing the establishment, political class, journalists, official journalists and such, in frenzies of denunciation, cancellation, people losing jobs, cops beating people fiendishly. It seems like this is related to a legitimacy crisis of the political class. They're losing some of that around this issue in particular, but I think it's a broader problem as well. And they're reacting with extreme verbal and physical force, but they've just lost the consensus, the legitimacy that they once had.
Well, look at the issue. I mean, look at what we're talking about. 15,000 or somewhere around there children killed in Gaza. Whatever you might say about Hamas or this or that or the other, 15,000 children killed there. And then these videos of Israeli soldiers playing with the lingerie of Palestinian women, you know, from extreme places of privacy, going into their drawers and pulling out their underwear and making jokes and even tying it to the front of tanks. There is something wrong with this situation. People are reacting to all that, Doug. I mean, this is qualitatively different than every other bombardment that Israel has done of Gaza. There's something qualitatively different. I can't put my finger on it, but I know it's very different. It's not just that the images are there. They were there 10 years ago, in 2014. They were, in fact, there in Kaslet. This is not that different in terms of the visuals. But there is something qualitatively different, whether it's just the sheer number of people who are continually being slaughtered or combination of that with the kind of really repulsive language coming not only out of Tel Aviv and so on, but also United States high officials. The other day I watched, and look, I know he's not a high official, he's a clownish figure, but the other day I watched an episode of Mustafa Barghouti, the doctor from Palestine, on Piers Morgan's show. And alongside them was this clownish figure, Alan Dershowitz. He's a man of influence. I said he's clownish, but it's not that he's regarded as clownish by the high elites. He's a person of some influence and renown. He's forever on television. But there he was, unable to listen to this Palestinian man talk with some feeling about the situation in Gaza. And when Mr. Barghouti said 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, Dershowitz interrupted him to say that they are not all civilians. And I thought, you know, okay, let's say they're not all civilians. Let's say 70% of us civilians. That's still a lot of people, man. And, you know, you can't say that 10, 15,000 children are anything other than civilians. There is a kind of callousness that is there in Tel Aviv, in Washington, people like Mr. Dershowitz, callous disregard for what's right in front of the face. And I think a new generation is born, including my children, who basically look at this and say, you know, we don't respect these people. Okay, they won't even say a word like ceasefire. They will use a garbage phrase like sustainable ceasefire. I was talking to some young people about this. And here's the interesting thing. You remember that we grew up in an era when people talked about development. You know, we need development. Development meant some form of sovereignty over an economy, industrialization, that, you know, you didn't just export raw materials Before the harbor comes the factory or the processing unit. That was the dream of development. And then these same clownish people or their intellectuals, they said, no, no, no. What you need is sustainable development. You know, it has to have some environmental component. And then the talk of industrialization goes off the table. Somehow, industrialization in the third world today will be responsible for climate change. When all one is saying is move the factory from country X to country Y. So country Y can actually add some value to what they're exporting. But no, no, they said, no, no, it's now sustainable development. Well, you can't have a ceasefire now. You can only have a sustainable ceasefire. For the life of me, I don't know what that means. What is a sustainable ceasefire? What is it when they talk about a humanitarian pause? You know, this does not appeal to young people. They want clarity, some moral clarity. They don't want prevarication, and that's what they're getting. They're getting that around the climate. They're getting that on Palestine. They're getting that on the economy. They're getting garbage. For a generation, young people have been told the way to get ahead is entrepreneurship. Really, Bill Clinton, that's the goods you sold a whole generation. What entrepreneurship? How can you massify entrepreneurship? Doesn't work like that. Somebody's going to have to work in the factory building the product that the entrepreneur came up with. Or somebody's going to have to work behind a computer producing those services. You can't all get rich by entrepreneurship. That's a lie. But remember that lie. They fed us that lie a generation ago. So the kids now are no longer willing to stomach words like entrepreneurship, sustainable development, sustainable ceasefire, humanitarian. They want clarity. They want ceasefire. They want jobs. You know, they want decency. They don't want bullshit. And I think that's the qualitative change. It's not the nature of the Israeli violence that's qualitatively different. It's that young people are fed up. They've had it on climate and they've had it on this. And they're basically telling their leaders, we are going to haunt you. We're coming everywhere. You're going to give a speech at a church? I'll be there. You're going to go cut a ribbon somewhere? I'll be there. You can eject me, but there'll be 100 more of me. And I think that is something that these mediocre leaders are going to have to seriously, seriously reflect on.
That was a historian, journalist, publisher, and think tank director, among his many occupational titles, Vijay Prashad. His article, The Remarkable Decline in the Global North's Leadership, can be found on the NewsClick website, newsclick.in. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
There is power in a factory, there is power in the land, there is power in the hand of the worker. But it all amounts to nothing if together we don't stand. Oh, there is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The mistakes of the bosses we must pay for. From the cities and the farmlands to the factories full of mud. War has always been the boss's way, sir. The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black flag, all workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters from many far-off lands. Oh, there is power in a union.
That was some of There Is Power in a Union, sung by John Darnielle of the Mountain Goats. For many years, the Mountain Goats were just him, though he eventually expanded their ranks. And now a somewhat related story, an excerpt from a much longer interview with the Ukrainian sociologist Vladimir Ischenko. Verso has collected some of Ischenko's writings from over the last decade into a book, Towards the Abyss, Ukraine from Maidan to War. He grew up in Kiev, taught sociology there, and was very active in the small New Left in his home country. Staying there became untenable, and now he is a researcher at the Freie Universität in Berlin. Essays in the book cover a lot of topics. Ischenko looks at the political forces behind the Maidan uprisings of 2013-14, which were romanticized in the West, but which had many unpleasant elements as well, notably the presence of the far right. He examines the taxonomy of Ukrainian elites divided between the oligarchs who got rich by stealing state property when the USSR collapsed, and whose orientation was nationalist and inward-looking, and very tied to state largesse, and a Western-oriented new class hot to join the EU, also much romanticized in the West, but without a large base in the population. He explores the relationship of Ukraine to the Soviet Union, seen in the West as one of colonization, a view Ischenko rejects. The USSR turned Ukraine from an agricultural society in the margins of Europe into a modern educated society. The collapse of the USSR led to a total demodernization. Where his analysis ties into Vijay Prashad's is in the absence of any project of civilization in Ukraine, and in Russia too. Putin stabilized Russia after its collapse in the 1990s, but there's never been any agenda to reverse the post-Soviet stagnation. Ishchenko sees pre-war Ukraine as a paradigm of the broader world's current predicament, fragmented, adrift, lacking any positive social vision. Here's a bit over half of an interview I did with Ishchenko. I'll probably broadcast other bits in the coming weeks. I apologize if this is a listening challenge. I put a lot of work into editing his comments, but I can't make him sound like a native English speaker. Vladimir Ishchenko.
In the discussions of the contemporary Ukraine, there is a fixation, at least in part of the public, also in the West, even more so in Russia, but also within Ukraine, on the supposedly language conflict. There is some reality behind that. So if you look at the politics of the post-Soviet Ukraine, during each election, we would see the regional cleavage on the electoral maps. So typically the western and central regions voted for one candidate and the majorities in the eastern and southern regions voted for another candidate. Perhaps it exists in the United States where states vote for either Democrats or Republicans, and this kind of like voting is pretty consistent. Or I'm in Germany now, and Germany also has a pretty strong regional cleavage, which is also connected to the post-socialist reality. So the eastern lands in Germany vote, there is much more support for the far-right party Alternative for Germany. And some people try to look at Ukraine in this way. I think that there is, in fact, a social reality behind this political cleavage. However, this social reality is not necessarily so much connected to the region or language, or at least these are not so most important factors. And furthermore, even the formation of the Russian-speaking Ukrainians, of the political specificity of the eastern and southern regions, should be understood as an outcome of the material forces, of the forces of the social revolution, which Ukraine experienced as a part of the Soviet Union. Within this state, Ukraine was actually becoming a modern nation and also experiencing a revolutionary modernization breakthrough, which created the modern Ukraine, in fact. It doesn't mean that Putin is right saying that basically like Bolsheviks invented Ukrainians, because Ukrainian identity existed even before Bolsheviks. However, most of the people who populated Ukraine started to feel themselves Ukrainians. They've got an education in Ukrainian language. They've got the development of the Ukrainian culture, even though, of course, there were a lot of repression. But nevertheless, Ukraine as a modern nation was constituted in the Soviet Union. So this was the factor of the social revolution. Some people in Ukraine, indeed, they identify themselves as Russian-speaking Ukrainians, but this is not the majority of those Ukrainians who actually prefer to speak in Russian among their friends and families and on the social context, which do not require communication in the Ukrainian language. So this is typically the official context, the education, and so on. And so how these people appeared? They were an outcome of the Soviet modernization. So the initial policies of Bolsheviks were about Ukrainianization. What they were interested in the making the Soviet power understandable for the local population and also legitimate among the local population. Bolsheviks took power in the world maneuver. They defeated all the competitors. And when they took power, that power could not rely simply on coercion. They required consent, they required legitimacy. And this way of becoming rooted in the local cultures, in the local peoples on the periphery of the former Russian Empire was important for strengthening and stabilizing and legitimating the Soviet power. So the initial policies were about Ukrainianization. Since the 1930s, the Ukrainianization was kind of like reduced, And the further modernization and nation building in the late Soviet Union after the Second World War was built primarily on the Russian language and culture. We may think about this as a kind of like a civic or political nation building. So there was indeed a claim that the Soviet Union is building Soviet people. The Soviet people was a nation building project. So this was a community united by the adherence, or at least according to the communist ideologies, to the socialist culture, to the loyalty to the communist project, united by the socialist economy, and supposedly all the members of all the nations of the Soviet Union would constitute this so-called Soviet people. And in fact, that Soviet identity became rooted among a quite large part of the population of the Soviet Union. So even in Ukraine, in the 1990s, right after the Soviet Union collapse, a quite considerable part of the population, up to 20%, said that they were not so much Ukrainians, but Soviets. That was not a majority, but that was an important minority. So I'm just explaining that it was indeed a nation-building project. Civic nation-building projects, they're never ethnically neutral. And so the language and culture of the dominant nation was at the core of this Soviet nation-building project. So specifically in this way, the Russian-speaking Ukrainians as a part of the population we know as contemporary Ukraine has appeared. As it was a nation-building project, as it was a modernization project, and not actually a colonization. And this is a very important thing to understand, because it became kind of like very much pushed in the contemporary debates. And after the Russian invasion, there is a strong push to start retrospectively reinterpret the centuries of Ukraine and Russia history. In the book, in fact, I'm giving some of my family history. How my grandparents and great-grandparents coming from Ukrainian villages or from Ukrainian-speaking workers, taking Russian language and also starting Russian-speaking families and then also educating my father and mother, who also then started a Russian-speaking family in Kyiv, because this was not a language of oppression for them. This was a language of social advancement. They were moving from countryside to the cities. They were getting higher education. They were taking the language of the educated layers in the urban environment. And this was a social progress for them. Precisely because this was a process of modernization, of social advancement, that language and cultural practice became so rooted in the experience of at least part of the contemporary Ukrainians. And precisely because the post-Soviet transformation was not modernization, but demodernization, collapse, involution. Russian-speaking Ukrainians have not been switching to the Ukrainian language. To some extent, they started to switch in response to Russian aggressive actions. Some in 2014, even more so in 2022. But this for them is a political choice. It has not been predetermined by their ethnic identity or any kind of history. This is a political choice for at least part of the people. Other Russian-speaking Ukrainians are still staying with this language and cultural practice. And it also doesn't predetermine that they are either pro-Russian or pro-invasion or whatever.
With the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's been no, and this is true of the other post-Soviet republics as well, there's just been no comparable project of national development. It's just been, seems like a large vacuum has been left behind, and strange things have filled that vacuum.
This is true. So my analysis is that all those 30 years of post-Soviet changes were fundamentally the permanent crisis. In Ukraine, we've seen the rapid turnover of different governments. So only one of the Ukrainian presidents, Leonid Kuchma, in 1999, was capable to be re-elected for the second term. And some people claim that this is that such turnover of the governments in Ukraine is proof of democracy. So look then on Russia, where Putin ruling basically with a very short break when he switched with Medvedev. Since 2000, for 24 years and may rule for 14 years more if he's going to be elected this year once again. Well, look at Lukashenko, who is ruling for his sixth term, if I'm not mistaken. So these are dictatorships, but Ukraine is so vibrant, it's changing the governments, but it's not necessarily a sign of the democracy. Democracy requires much more than the capacity to change a government in the elections, at least from more progressive and from more left-wing understanding of democracy. That's a sign of crisis, that we didn't have any stable government. And even now, when Zelensky became super popular after the Russian invasion, some polls showed him like over 90% of support and trust. But it also looked like that initial consolidation in 2022 was a temporary response to the initial shock of invasion and also to the failure of that invasion, which was probably even more important factor than the invasion in fact. The Russians were not only like bastards who attacked Ukraine, but they were also idiots who, like in the very first weeks, suffered quite humiliating defeats. And then there was huge push towards beliefs in the Ukrainian victory, especially after victories near Kharkov and Kherson in the fall of 2022. But then, when the counteroffensive failed, we also see the crumbling of Zelensky ratings, crumbling of the trust to the state institutions, to the government, to the parliament, and so on and so forth. So that if that so much depended on the developments on the battlefield, it's not exactly the sign of Ukraine overcoming that continuous crisis of hegemony. Why we actually didn't have any of the comparable project, there are global factors and also local factors. Ukraine is a magnifying glass for the global problems. Actually, do not have a comparable forward-looking project for any part of the world, perhaps. So although the claims about neoliberal hegemony became kind of like a buzzword, it's actually pretty questionable to which extent neoliberal project offered modernization, offered development. Only some groups, minorities, and the representative of some segments of the working class or middle classes, they could win from neoliberalism, but more like individuals, as individual consumers, as individual small entrepreneurs, but not as representatives of their groups. And so if the whole project is fundamentally about redistribution of wealth to the richest, then on which material basis you could build that developmental project? The projects for the post-war Western states or for the Soviet Union were fundamentally different, about moving the whole societies ahead. And that's why we are speaking about modernization and progress.
The European decolonization of the European colonies in the 60s, for example, occurred during a time when there's a possibility of an imagination about the future, but there doesn't seem to be much of one about that now.
Not anymore. So globally, Soviet Ukraine didn't have a global offer when the Soviet project collapsed. And also locally, there was a very specific kind of capitalism which was emerging in Ukraine, where the people who got immensely rich in the first post-Soviet years didn't have any traditional religious ideological legitimation for privatizing the state property. That's how many of them actually became oligarchs, super rich. Precisely the success of the Soviet Revolution and the construction of the powerful communist hegemony apparatus, which then degenerated and collapsed, left also a big void in the post-Soviet politics and the society, with a pretty weakly organized civil society incapable to represent even, let's say, corporate interests in the society, and also lacking genuine political representatives. The political parties were also pretty weak. In the case of Ukraine, it looked like a competition of deficient, not even a competition of deficient projects, but one deficient project which didn't have even a comparable alternative. The deficient project, I mean, the project of Ukraine joining EU, NATO, and basically moving into Western direction.
Agenda that did not have a lot of popular support.
Up to 2014, it actually didn't have the majority support. So, for example, the support for NATO integration was limited to a small minority before 2014. In 2008, when NATO held that famous summit in Bucharest, when they decided about Ukraine and Georgia, that they are going to become eventually members of NATO in some indefinite future. But at that moment, in 2008, support for NATO in Ukraine was less than 20%. So they decided for Ukrainian population. And only after Russia annexed Crimea, after Russia started to support the separatists in Donbass and also even more escalating the events there, only then Ukraine got not even a majority, but plurality. So let's say about 40% of more or less stable support for joining NATO. These were the polls which were conducted without Crimea, without Donbass, the most pro-Russian and anti-NATO population of Ukraine. So they were formally claimed to be Ukrainians, and formally Ukraine has never released. Effectively, they were excluded from the public sphere of Ukraine, and their voice didn't matter anymore. And now, of course, after 2022, the support for NATO is likely to be very strong, although the polls became quite unreliable. But nevertheless, it may also be an outcome of that temporary consolidation, which may depend very much on the outcomes on the battlefield.
That was Vladimir Ischenko, a Ukrainian sociologist who is a researcher at the Freie Universität Berlin. A collection of his writings, Towards the Abyss, Ukraine from Maidan to War, has just been published by Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go on with this, some of the fourth movement of Dmitri Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, The Leningrad, which memorializes the defeat of the Nazis' siege of that city. It's performed by the New York Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Leonard Bernstein. Till next week, bye.